Good evening, Montreal, and everybody listening on the World Wide Web. The war in the Middle East is giving us all a respite a bit from the war issues, from the military issues, from the political issues, but not from the perception issues. And we're going to be taking a look at that and how perception and polling affects us all in a wide variety of issues. Much of what we think isn't determined by what we read. There's not enough time. It's determined by headlines. Many of those headlines are determined by polls, which aren't always accurate, and in fact, are often skewed by the very questions that are asked of people. But they get the headlines. Whatever number pops up, it got to the point that of being so bad that the last administration that governed this country wouldn't move without some focus group. And yet those groups can be skewed. The questions you're asked can be skewed. Your very futures can be skewed simply by how one person decides to ask a series of questions and report back to a client. And that is a major threat to what we consider the quality of democracy. And our first guest right after this break will be Conrad Wynn, president of Compass Polling, on a very contentious issue that arose during the Mideast crisis, but had to do with Canadians' perception of it, and it had to do with what happened with a poll commissioned by the prestigious Globe and Mail, that depending on where you sit, is either Canada's national newspaper or something different, a different kind of animal that has an agenda of its own. How we accept and understand how the pulse of this country is taken, and whether we have the ability to develop a critical eye on the headlines, will determine very much of the quality of our democracy as we go forward. We're going to be back with Conrad Wynn right after this. Or email us at info@iapm.ca. First question we're tackling today is polling and perception. And how much are polling and focus groups affecting the very quality of our democracy and affecting your ability not only to understand the issues, but politicians' abilities to respond to what we really think? Our first guest is Conrad Wynn, president of Compass Polling, and he's one of the best in the business, and we're going to focus in on one particular issue. And that was a poll that was done on how many Canadians backed the Middle East, backed the Prime Minister's stand on the Middle East crisis. The Harper government elected in January of 2006. He certainly didn't hide his views. And 6 months later, the Globe and Mail declared in massive headlines that Canadians were in an uproar of the new government's perceived pro-Israel, anti-Hezbollah stance. It wasn't so much perceived, it was stated. But Calgary-based Western Standard magazine wondered, how could this possibly be so? And the Globe and Mail had these big headlines. 45% disagree with the Prime Minister's position, which would imply that 55% are either neutral or agree. Instead, the sub-headline was 77% want Canadian neutrality. Western Standard contracted with Compass for a second professional opinion, and the Compass poll revealed an entirely different portrait of where Canadians stand. And if Toronto's Globe and Mail had permitted respondents the same wide range of options, the Globe's headline would have been different. Something like, instead of only 32% back Prime Minister in the Middle East, to an average 64% back the Prime Minister in the Middle East. And this is true on a wide range of issues. And Conrad Wynn, thanks for taking the time to be with us. How do these things happen? How easy is it to skew polls?
It's not that difficult. Especially, the more complex the issue, the easier it is. I mean, in the extreme, you could do all sorts of terrible things, but I don't see polling firms doing all sorts of terrible things. I think, by and large, their samples are probably fine. And if you noticed, when it comes to election times, they're not that inaccurate, and they tend to converge. And when there's a problem, when there's a big problem, it's because the voters have made much of their decision after the last pollster is polled. So the big problems are the more complex issues. Any kind of policy issue is a complex issue. Foreign affairs issue is especially complex. And you run into problems here. You run into problems partly because of the media rather than the pollster. The media are in the business of of extracting the loudest screaming headline for the lowest cost. The ideal poll for newspapers is often, not always. Some newspapermen are just so scrupulous and careful. But for many, the ideal poll is the cheapest possible poll, preferably free, that gives a screaming headline that...
Wait a minute. Why would somebody make a poll for free?
Well, my impression is that most polls in the media are for free. Because the pollsters want to get a promotion, and it's advertising masquerading as news.
Right.
And there's an irony to this because the media's standards for truthfulness and ethical performance, as applied to other people, are higher than the ones they themselves observe, and which is kind
Isn't that a shocker?
Yeah. Exactly. The conversation.
Well, you've only been doing this, you've only been doing this for about 6 months, right, Conrad? So this is news to you.
Well, I'm a youthful old man, so I continue to get shocked.
So how did this poll? How did these numbers? You know, I looked in that when that Globe and Mail poll came out. I looked at the questions inside. No question related to the other question.
Well, I mean, I looked at it. First of all, the headline was absurd, and then I looked at the details, and then I phoned them up, and I said, will you let me write a short essay explaining some of the limitations of the poll? And they said, no, we're not in the market for this. So so when Western Standard asked us to do another poll, you know, the answer was obviously yes. So we might not have agreed to do it if the Globe had let us write a little essay.
Give us generically an idea, an example of two questions and how they were at, would be asked differently in that particular poll.
Sure.
The way the Globe and Mail did it and the way you did it. An example of a question.
Okay. Their key question was something close to, how do you feel about Harper's support for Israeli actions? Now, actions are a negative word. You know, a typical phrase with the word action.
Yeah, it's a key word. It's a code word.
Yeah, it would be, explain your actions, young man. It's not a neutral word. It's not like policy. And in that context, it conjures up airstrikes. If Mother Teresa were in charge of an air force, she would be subject to great opprobrium. We don't believe that we should shoot people and or bomb people. So it foreordained the answer. And then when they, but that's kind of boring and obvious. The one that I had a lot of fun with. Excuse me, I have one of those allergic coughs.
Oh, I did this yesterday. I had it all night.
The one I had fun with was the question where the Globe asked people why Harper has the policy he has, and they gave respondents only three options. Of course, people can only express their views within the options
right. That
they're offered. And one of the options was on principle. Well, we live in an age of skepticism. If our mother were an MP, we wouldn't accuse her of ever being motivated by principle. That who's going to say that a politician's motivated by principle? And then another option was for domestic political considerations.
Which is already...
Well, if you had 100...
Red light code words.
If you had 10 PhDs in political science in a room to define what that means, you get 20 different definitions. And the average person doesn't have a clue. That what is domestic to the average person? Probably 20% of Canadians think domestic means a maid. They don't have a maid. And if they did, they wouldn't ask her what she thought of the Middle East. You know, so that's confusing to people. And does it mean, is it code word for protect our export opportunities in the United States? Because the Americans take almost 9 out of 10 dollars of our exports.
Right.
And we're an export-dependent nation. Or does it mean abide by the preferences of Canadians to support democratic Israel over a terrorist Hezbollah? Does it mean worry about the Jewish and Christian evangelical vote? What does it mean? Not clear.
Conrad,
Yeah. Hold
the thought. We're just going to pay a bill, and we're going to come back with some clarity from you on what questions should be asked and what questions you asked.
Sure.
We'll be right back with Conrad Wynn of Compass Polling right after this. We're talking about polls and polling and how it affects our perceptions, and we want to know from you whether you think the polls that you generally read about reflect what you're thinking. And if you've ever been called by a pollster, we'd like to know what you think. And our special guest is Conrad Wynn, president of Compass Polling, one of the best in the business. And we're talking about a specific case here of really almost disinformation, a Globe and Mail poll that was skewed on Canadians' perceptions and Canadians' opinions about the Prime Minister's support of Israel in the recent Mideast war. Conrad, one of the things you found, before I ask you how you would change the question or how you change the questions, was the numbers were so weird in the Globe and Mail poll, the 45% who seemed to be against the Prime Minister's position, which would indicate 55% were neutral or for it, yet 77% then wanted neutrality, according to the Globe and Mail, yet your poll found 69% favored treatment of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization and can support continuing policy of making it illegal in Canada. So what question did you ask around that?
Sure. No, let me answer that, but let me just try to summarize it really concisely. There are two issues here. What do Canadians really think, and how did the Globe and Mail poll get it so wrong? What do Canadians really think? They're very anti-Hezbollah. And you see that in the answer to two questions that we asked and the Globe didn't. One is, do you think Hezbollah should continue to be treated as a terrorist organization under Canadian law? 69% said yes. The remainder were divided between no and I don't know. It was 5-1, continue to treat them as a terrorist organization. 5-1. You don't get 5-1 agreeing that mothers are good.
That's a pretty good spread.
Okay, and then among those who said they should continue to be treated as a terrorist organization.
And you even got 2-1 in Quebec.
Even more than, yeah. 2-1 in Quebec, and then among those who believe it should be treated as a terrorist organization, we then said, do you think it should be a criminal offense to support Hezbollah? You know, mere support, you know, carrying a flag.
Right.
And 72% of those said yes. Now, 72 times 69 is 50%. One out of two Canadians thinks that you should send people to jail for supporting Hezbollah. Not just Hezbollah as an organization, but mere support. Now, that's extraordinary. I'm not saying that they will be outlawed. My point is another one. If half of Canadians believe that mere support for Hezbollah should be a criminal offense, there is just no way under the stars that the Globe report about a so-called uproar against Harper could have any validity. Okay, so that's one key issue. Where do Canadians stand? They're anti-Hezbollah, beginning, end. It's that simple. The second thing is, how did the Globe get it so wrong? Well, I talk about one of the questions where it used a negative word, Israeli actions. And then I was in the middle of talking about the other question where respondents were asked to explain why Harper has the views he does, and I explained how two of the questions were non-starters. No one's going to say he's motivated by principle. Politicians aren't perceived as motivated by principle. They ended up by saying, To be in line with George Bush. Well, in our survey, in the Compass survey, and your listeners can get details at compass.ca, compasswithones.ca.
I was about to give them the website.
Sure. Thank you. They can get the details there. We asked the same kind of question, why does he believe what he believes? But we gave them a wide range of options.
How many options?
Five.
And the Globe and Mail poll?
Three. But we gave them a range of them. So we gave them the option to say that George Bush is the puppeteer and Harper's the puppet. But instead of a majority saying that George Bush's position as a role model is what drives Harper, it's 12%. The least popular answer in our survey was George Bush. The biggest answer was a variation on Arab terrorism and Arab extremism. So Canadians basically said, that's why Harper takes the pro-Israel position.
So when you give them the choices of the questions,
yeah,
they get it. The poll reflects that Canadians really do get it.
Yeah, you know, the Globe and Mail poll reminded me of a cartoon we have at the Compass office, and we've had it for years. And it has an interviewer doing an interview, and the interviewer says something like, do you think that the emperor is extraordinarily good, substantially good, really good, or good most of the time? And the respondent says, I don't know which answer, but I know who paid for the poll.
Perfect.
You know, so you don't give people the option.
Sounds like sometimes the way we choose our governments, but at least under Martin, how he made his decisions.
Well, that may well be. But the issue is that a poll has got to be fair, and it's got to seem to be fair. And it's got to have a range of options, and you need a lot of questions. And we explored. Let me give you another example of where they didn't have enough questions.
Conrad, give me another example right after this break.
You bet.
Thanks. Welcome back, and you can email us at info@iapm.ca. We're talking about polls and polling and how they can skew our perceptions of public issues. Our special guest is Conrad Wynn, president of Compass. polling. That's Compass with one S, compas.ca, www.compass.ca. Go to the site. You'll see a lot of very interesting polls and a lot of major questions of the day. We're speaking specifically about a poll that the Globe and Mail did, whose numbers just didn't make any sense in Canadians' views on the Prime Minister's support of Israel. Compass then did a poll for the Western Standard, which showed a completely different, almost diametrically opposite view, and the reason was more options were given. And Conrad Wynn, before the break, you were about to give us an example of the kind of questions you're saying the more questions, the better the survey, and the kind of questions that should be given.
Yeah, exactly. And so if we get away from Arab radicalism versus Israel onto peacekeeping, where the emotions might be lower, this is another example where you get a completely different answer if you give them more options. So the Globe only gave them two options. Basically, are you for sending in peacekeepers or against? And it's not quite 2-1, but it's a clear majority for sending in peacekeepers. But we gave them three options. Do you want to send them in? Do you want to not send them in? Or do you want to send them in only if Hezbollah is first disarmed? And guess what? All of a sudden, only a quarter want to send in peacekeepers. So, you're catching people at home. They're not waiting for a pollster to phone. They're not waiting. They haven't prepared for to discuss far off countries and disputes.
They've come home after a hard day's work, and they're not into thinking about geopolitics.
And really, to do a good job, you really have to ask not only a lot of questions, ideally, but you have to give them a full panorama of response options.
This government has been criticized by some, but lauded by others, both for two things, both in its complete lack of desire to pander to the media. He will just say what he has to say when he has to say it. And unlike the previous administration, they're going ahead with their agenda. They're not really looking too closely at polling every single possible prism of an issue. Is that a good thing for a government to do, to stand on policy and principle? Where's the proper place of polling in a democratic society to determine a government's agenda?
Well, I mean, there's lots of kind of ideologically neutral uses of opinion research or customer research. Governments do provide all sorts of services where it doesn't matter if you're a New Democrat or a conservative, you need to know if the customers, the clients, the taxpayers understand the service, can wade through the website, can read the brochure, that kind of thing. And any government needs that kind of non-ideological, practical, customer-oriented research. When it comes to policy issues and policy research, it doesn't matter what my opinion is. The fact is that people who have an agenda, and sometimes it's public servants who have an agenda, they're going to do polling. They're going to do it in order to find out, what they can get away with. I mean, Einstein understood this ages ago. My favorite story from Einstein, this is a true story. It's an absolutely true story. He was giving a speech, and at the end of the speech, a gentleman came up to him and said, "Could I have a moment of your time?" And Einstein said, young man, how do I help you?" And the young man said, I really need your advice." And Einstein said, "Well, I'm not in the advice business. There are all sorts of advice columnists and advice therapists and advice specialists." And the young man said, No, I need your advice. What should I be when I grow up?" And Einstein said, "Oh, that's easy. Become a public opinion pollster. You see, politicians are in the business of telling tall tales, and they'll always need pollsters to tell them which ones they can get away with."
Perfect. Conrad Wynn, president of Compass Polling, thanks very much for spending so much time with us. www.compass.ca, Compass with one S. We'll be back with you right after this. We've talked often about the problem of the justice agenda, both under the Liberal government and under the Conservative government, being almost a bridge to the right, a bone for the right wing to chew on. Problematic issues, mandatory minimums, internet oversight, things that really aren't necessary. But today, Justice Minister Victor's comments that children as young as 10 and 11 who, quote, run afoul of the law can be brought to court, and then we should think about bringing them to court. this just defies all reason in my mind. And to help us sort out this question, and we certainly want to hear from you, but there's no one who knows this question more intimately than our next guest. Andre Rufo, thanks for joining us. This question is something you devoted your professional career to as a youth court judge. What is he thinking? What could he be thinking?
Well, I don't know, but I certainly think that he's not of these days and on this earth and this country. I think it's very sad even to dare to think that we're going to bring 10-year-old children, not even teenager, right? Children in court. I think that I haven't heard for all of these days, I haven't heard about parents. Where are the parents? And what kind of, you know, what are we talking about? And why is it that we have to think of court for those children? Shouldn't we think about education? I am very sad to hear a prime minister speaking like that.
Well, one of the prime ministers was a justice minister at a conference in at a Canadian Bar Association meeting in St. John's.
Yeah, but do you think that the justice minister speaks and speaks alone?
Well, this is a concern of mine, frankly. I had it under the Liberal government when Justice Minister Kotler introduced omnibus justice bills that had internet oversight, that had preventive control, electronic anklets. My concern is that the justice agenda is something that every government is just giving up to the right wing.
Yes.
You spent a career championing the rights of young people within a system as a youth court judge, but as a public advocate. Am I wrong in thinking that even young people have, when you look at their behavior, when you look at the possible criminality of behavior, are still entitled to be judged on the basis of whether or not they had intent or could formulate intent?
Well, that for me is very clear. I was just a few seconds ago having a birthday dinner, and I was speaking with my 86-year-old mother, and we were discussing that, and she was outraged. It is unacceptable that we think of our 10, 9, 10, 11-year-old children as criminals. It is crazy.
What is even more troubling? What is even more troubling in Mr. Toh's comments, and with perhaps, you know, with your experience, perhaps you could shed some light on this if there's any validity to what he's saying. I certainly don't find any. He said we need to find ways of ensuring children are deterred from crime. And one of the frustrations that has been expressed to me is that sometimes children, by the time they're 12, because the courts have been unable to access them under the Youth Criminal Justice Act, have in fact established a pattern of conduct that will be harmful. By the age of 12, you establish a pattern of behavior that will be harmful?
I think we should laugh. I think we should not take that seriously. I think we should laugh at people who dare to say things like that. I think we should ridiculize. I think that it has nothing to do with our children, with our parents, with our school, with our values. It has nothing to do with our society. I think that when we take them too seriously, we give them some opportunity to, you know, just to have a public place to discuss it.
Right.
Let us laugh about them. This has nothing to do with our children. Nothing, nothing, nothing to do. You know, if the Justice Minister or the Prime Minister would look at his own children and think at 10 years old he could bring them to court, he would find himself stupid.
You know, what I found amusing in just some background on this story is that just this past May, the Philippines raised the age of criminal responsibility from 9 to 15.
Mm.
And we want to drop it. They're raising it, and we want to drop it.
Is it because we are really becoming barbarians? Is it really because we deny everything that we have taken so long to learn, to listen to our children? Why does a child of 10 would bring some arms at school? What is he saying? Where are the parents? What kind of, you know, prevention we could do? And is it harmful? We were discussing just a few minutes ago, when we were Girl Guides, we would go to school with our knives.
And I know you're dangerous with a knife, Andre Rufo.
Pardon me?
I know you're dangerous with a knife, Andre Rufo.
No, I don't think so. But I think it is so sad We just have to dismiss that suttees and say, okay, let's talk about something intelligent. Let's talk about something that is worth it. It's just nonsense. Nonsense at all.
Andre Ruffo, I want, please stay with us just after this short break, because you asked a very important question. Where are the parents? And I want to discuss with you what's happening in Britain, and is that acting as some kind of a spark for what's happening here? Because there's some crazy things happening over there. Montreal will be right back after this with Andre Ruffo. We're talking with former youth court judge Andre Ruffo about this ludicrous suggestion that Justice Minister Vic Toews threw out at the Canadian Bar Association meetings in St. John's about treating 12-year-olds and 10-year-olds and 11-year-olds, sorry, under the criminal justice system. And, Andre, you asked in our previous segment, where are the parents? What about the parents? I want to ask you what you think of this projet de loi, this legal proposal in Britain. Now, Britain has a Labour government, progressive. Yeah. This is what they've thrown on the table and is now being considered. That if your child is being disruptive in the community and youth protection has to visit him more than twice, you as the parents are obligated to go to what is being called or proposed a National Parenting Academy. And then after returning from that course, if yet again your child is disruptive or does something that's afoul of the law, you can lose your child. I mean, where is the West going?
So we have a conservative government here where
we can, you know, you could say, okay, conservative justice minister, fine, he throws out this ludicrous suggestion. But you asked a very important question. What about the parents? They're losing their rights in England under a Labour government.
But for me, it's not a surprise. The less we're going to take care of our children, wanting them, caring for them, loving them, the more we're going to be afraid of them, and we will have to control them, punish them, and put them away. So that has been the trend for so many centuries. You know, we started looking at children when we were first afraid of them, not because we loved them, not because they were unique persons and we should take that into consideration, just because they became angry, they committed crimes, so forth and so on. That is the history of children. I think that if a parent is very neglecting his children, I think that if it is proven, then there should be some consequences on the parents. But I have yet to see an equation between a parent who does his best and a child who commits a crime. I think there's no equation. There's no equation. That has never been proven. Never, never, never. We have children who come from families that both parents are drug addicted and they're involved in crimes, and they are marvelous, beautiful children and going on with their lives as a healthy citizen. We have other children, they come from good parents doing their best, and they're involved in all sorts of things. There's no equation. I don't know how they can even think having such a law. It's ridiculous. It goes against everything we know in psychology, in psychiatry, in psychoanalysis. It has to go...
And in law as far as intent.
Exactly.
How does
a
10-year-old or 11-year-old formulate intent?
Yeah, maybe later on we could have a woman being responsible for her husband doing this and that. Maybe we could have, you know, the opposite. Where are we going to stop? It is ridiculous. But bottom line, it's because we're afraid of our children. Bottom line, because we don't care for them.
Now, you said that often, that we're afraid of our children.
Yes.
You said it often in speeches. What do you mean by that?
I mean that when a child is in need of protection, neglected, having parents who are drug addicts, somebody who has, you know, problems, you know, learning disability, we don't care. We don't provide them with the proper services because they're only children and we don't even care for their needs and for them. But when the child becomes nasty, aggressive, violent, then the society reacts, not because we love our children, because we're afraid of them. We are afraid of them disturbing the society, going into homes, being violent, committing, you know, mischief or so forth and so on. And that's when we get interested in children, not before.
Well, Andre Ruffo, as long as we have voices like yours speaking with clarity and candor and courage, we will be less afraid of our children and less afraid of each other and have the courage to build the kind of society that will value compassion over contempt. Thanks very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Montreal, that's it for tonight. Thank you to Chris Smith and Master Control. We'll see you tomorrow.